Thank you very much, and hello to everyone. I'm very conscious today that there's a raft of people coming after me who are also going to talk on very much the same topic. What I'm going to do is try to cover a comprehensive horizontal view of the carbon market and where we stand in terms of its implementation, rather than trying to go into the details on specific areas, and I think there may well be a scope for that later on in this session. So what I'll be covering is, first of all, what do we actually have in terms of the UN agreement? Those will be familiar, I think, to a lot of you. And then I'll be talking about the various elements that we have which make up in some fashion the carbon market that we have today. It's not a unified system. It's much more characterized by fragmentation. But nevertheless, it's functioning in some form, and it's actually quite successful in the way it's functioning. So we'll look at how far we've come, what the status of the implementation is, and then also look at some of the future directions that are taking shape, particularly through the international negotiations at the moment. So in terms of the international frameworks, as I say, they'll be familiar to you. We have the convention under the UN, which does not actually have any targets as such. What it has is a general framework and a stabilization objective, and this is where also the concept of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities has come from. Kyoto Protocol followed several years later in 1997, and this is the one with stronger teeth. This has actual targets for developed countries or Annex I parties. And those targets operate for the period 2008 to 2012, so they're measured over a five-year period. Kyoto has almost universal participation. It does have some fairly notable exceptions, as I'm sure you're aware of. And the stage where we're at now is really to take both of these agreements, the Convention and the Kyoto Protocol, and look at how they can be taken forward into the post-2012 period. And it's here in Montreal where 4 years ago the AWGKP is the ad hoc working group on further commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. It was launched after 4 years. I think we could say that the limited progress that's been shown there is testament to just how difficult it is to try and get 190-odd countries to agree. I'm sure you'll be following some of the discussions there. It's a very complex field that we've had. The last 2 years has also seen, since the Bali conference, the AWG ad hoc working group on long-term cooperative action to ensure the full implementation of the convention. This has been the second negotiating group running in parallel to the first, and in Copenhagen last year was a very, very large conference where these two negotiation groups were to deliver, and as we know, that wasn't fully successful. I'll say a little bit more about that later on. So on Kyoto itself, I think it's really characterized by having specific targets. And these are the percentage targets. You see that some countries were to keep the same level of emissions in 2008 to 2012 that they did back in 1990. Others had reduction targets of -6, -7, -8% that you can see there. And then there's other countries which were able under Kyoto to increase their emissions, albeit still below what they would have been under business as usual. The way that the compliance system works for Kyoto is actually where the carbon market comes from under the Kyoto system. And you can see it here. If you look at the red rectangle as being an area, the amount of allowances or assigned amount, as it's called in the Kyoto jargon, that defining how much a country is able to emit. And then the emissions much higher, so the country needs to reduce its emissions. Perhaps it's in a situation where it's not cost-effective to do all of that through its own domestic reduction, so it's also buying in some allowances from other countries or somehow generating other credits. And we know that we can simply buy assigned amount allowances, assigned amount units, at the country level to do this. There can also be credits which are generated under the CDM and JI, and there's also ways of increasing activities in land use and forestry sectors in order to sequester carbon and thereby create and generate further credits through this. So what this in effect does is it sets the compliance level which a country needs to meet higher than the original target. So it's this flexibility which has enabled the country to reduce the cost in meeting its actual target under Kyoto. And you can see that it's the creation of the market demand there through trying to buy in all these additional allowances, together with other countries being in the opposite position where they've actually got a surplus of credits allowances that they can put on the market, that is actually where this market that we have comes from. And I'm really talking here about the government level, but there are provisions within Kyoto to allow this to occur at the company level as well, and I'll come back to that. As you know, there are two project-based mechanisms under Kyoto as well. The first one, joint implementation, is about investments into from one developed country into another developed country. There's around 300 projects which are in the pipeline for this. Not all of them are registered, and this covers what's called Track 1 and Track 2, which is essentially the amount of international oversight that there is over the JI projects themselves. It's been, compared to the Clean Development Mechanism, it's been much later in starting, because the CDM was able to start already from 2001 through some special provisions which were agreed. So JI has been coming up a bit later than CDM, but now there's over 6 million credits or EIUs, emission reduction units, which have been issued for JI. For the Clean Development Mechanism, this is much, much bigger. This is where the investments are being placed into projects in developing countries. We've currently got 2,200 approximately projects which have been registered, and these have so far created about 400 million CERs, or the credits coming from the CDM. There is a lot more projects in the pipeline for this. It's estimated to be somewhere above 2,000 projects which have not yet reached the registration stage, so they're being developed. And there are various estimates as to how many credits or CERs are actually going to be issued as a result of this entire pipeline of projects. And there's estimates going up to about 2.9 billion credits by the end of 2012. There are lower estimates as well. It really depends on how much these CDM projects are going to deliver. So thinking, sort of moving from the level of the governments down to the level of individual companies, you can see that what a lot of governments are doing and have been doing in some cases for some time is to devolve a portion of their national target, a portion of the responsibility for emissions down to company levels. And the clearest example we have is in the EU, where they've taken around 45-50% of emissions, and the responsibility for that has been devolved to the 12,000 or so installations which are covered by that scheme. It's all these regulatory trading schemes are mandatory in nature, so it's specified who needs to be covered by the schemes and therefore who needs to surrender the allowances and credits at the end of the compliance period. The system-wide caps, which are set to then decline over time in order to drive the reductions, and the overall impact of this is that there has actually been an opportunity cost created for carbon. That is to say that before emitting carbon, if you're covered by the scheme, before you go off and carry on your business as usual activities in order to emit the carbon, you think twice about it and think, if I can save my, if I can reduce some of my emissions, then I'm going to have a surplus to be able to sell. So there is an opportunity cost which has been created. That's on the regulatory side. What should also be mentioned is there's a very strong voluntary offset market which has been developed. And this is not really cap and trade. It's all voluntary. This is where companies are actually going out on the market and they're buying offset credits. And there are various certification standards which are available for that. It should be said that it's not really the standards themselves which define whether an activity is voluntary or not. You do have some voluntary actors in this market who are buying CDM certified reductions. So on the next slide, I'll just run through some of the trading schemes which there are out there at the moment. The most well-known one is the EU, which I've already talked a little bit about. It started in 2005 already. It's under its phase 3 rules, which have been determined. It goes through until 2020. In principle, it's a trading scheme which is indefinite. It just keeps on going on, and there are new targets formulated for companies in each compliance period. As you know, also the international aviation flights into and out of Europe are also to be included within the ETS from 2012 onwards. The EU has very much been the main driver of the carbon market as we know it. It's certainly been the main driver of the CDM as well, and it's really the benchmark to which a lot of countries are looking at the moment. What should also be said is that it's going through difficult times at the moment with the recession. There's been a downturn in emissions and consequently an oversupply of units, which has happened now for the second compliance period running, and it's raising many discussions there. But it must be said that the scheme, according to the studies which have been done, does appear to have reduced emissions, and it does appear to have incorporated carbon prices into investment decisions which the private sector is making. To look at New Zealand, New Zealand introduced or passed legislation late last year which brings into place a staged emissions trading scheme. There's some sectors to be included already now from this year, particularly in the energy and industry and transport sectors. In 2013, there's to be more added, and then finally in 2013, I think it is. Agriculture is also to be included, or 2015, not quite sure about that anymore. So what you'll have at the end of the transition phase is a trading scheme which covers almost all of the emissions in New Zealand. Switzerland's had a voluntary cap and trade scheme and for some time, and this is really as an alternative to being faced with a CO2 tax. In Japan, Japan has had the approach of having voluntary cap and trade schemes in place for some time, for several years now. In 2008, this was taken up to another level where Japan integrated a number of schemes into what's called the experimental integrated emissions trading scheme, but it remains voluntary. What Japan has just done this year is to introduce a bill into Parliament which would introduce a mandatory trading scheme into Japan, and there's been quite a lot of opposition to this which has been raised, which is not unusual, so we've yet to see how exactly that will turn out. And in the US, that's of course a big topic of conversation. We have a number of state level schemes which are already up and running in some cases, RGGI for example, and you have the Western Climate Initiative, which is also a very promising initiative where a number of states and provinces in Canada as well have joined together and undertaken to put in place emissions trading schemes. All of this would potentially fall away if a federal cap and trade scheme was to take place, and this is and still is very much a big topic for the US. Waxman Markey passed in the House last year, and now all eyes are on the KGL version of the bill, as is now to be discussed, the Kerry Graham Leadman version of the bill. This would see utilities covered first of all into a cap and trade scheme, with major industries being phased in at a later stage, and as a key development from the Waxman-Markey parts, it would have a fee-based structure for transport, fossil fuels and transport. Australia, just to end the slide, has had a cap and trade bill under consideration several times, and it's been defeated each time. Prime Minister Rudd has just announced recently that this would be now postponed until 2012. So how far have we come? In terms of the way we look at the market, and I guess as policymakers as well, to what extent is it meeting the objectives that it was intended for? One can certainly say that the market has substantially matured in the last year, and I guess this is really talking specifically about the EU, where it has seemed to have reduced emissions, and it is also having the impact on the investment decisions. What should also be said is there's a very strong interest in offsets, CDM, JI to a lesser extent, but also the voluntary schemes. And what we're seeing at the moment is the offset market is becoming, or is approaching the stage where it's saturated with the supply which is currently on offer. But what this really is a signal for is that there's a lot of offset credits which can be generated, and it's a matter of having the demand through the regulated cap and trade schemes to actually pull in those offset schemes. And that's something to bear in mind. The US is certainly thinking about it, and any initiatives in aviation as well would need to. The utility of trading approaches does, I think, seem to have been proven now. Certainly there's it has had an impact now in terms of driving the uptake of cost-effective abatement opportunities, so it is actually having the impact that it was intended to have there. It's not only an issue of having the opportunities to abate emissions, it's also a matter of actually implementing them, and that's what the various ETSs have been doing. There's also a very strong initiative here to level the playing field of incentives throughout the various jurisdictions. And what this means is that all the industry players in a particular sector are treated in the same way. And certainly that's the case within jurisdictions. What you see in the EU is you've got 27 member states, so that's a very large single jurisdiction. What's been more difficult is the level playing field between jurisdictions. And this is really an issue of, it has been in a number of cases very difficult to have emissions trading schemes at the domestic level introduced and passed through legislation. And what that is likely to lead to, if that continues to be the case, is to continue to have a fragmented market rather than having one universal scheme where you may, which is certainly broken down into a number of different systems, but you would allow there to be linking across them. The future international framework, certainly Copenhagen was a very difficult time. I think you'll have all heard about that. What we do have coming out of Copenhagen is a set of draft texts which governments are trying to agree on. We also have the Copenhagen Accord, which is being seen increasingly as not as an accord as such, but more as a political tool. It has a number of quite strong milestones in there, in particular the two degree maximum temperature rise. What it also has is a number of phrases which refer to markets. And one is that there is a decision amongst those parties that they would pursue opportunities to use markets. That means to establish more opportunities and establish more systems. We also have within the Copenhagen Accord a commitment to funding, fast-track funding of 30 billion up to 2012 already, and a target to be reached by 2020 where 100 billion US dollars would be set aside. And all of this money would go into assisting developing countries with their adaptation and mitigation. And one of the phrases within the text on this is that this money would be coming also from private sector sources as well as public sector sources. This is a signal that market instruments would be used for that. There is a number of reasons for using markets, and these are coming up very much in the negotiations. The flexibility point that I raised earlier on, flexibility in terms of meeting targets for developed countries, and really the financial flows which can come out of it, the enormous amount of money which is already channeled through the private sector, which has a big impact on emissions, and it's a matter of trying to draw in more engagement from the private sector in order to channel those investments, in particular in developing countries, but not only. I won't go through this in too much detail, but there are a number of areas where the CDM is to be strengthened. It's come under quite a lot of criticism. There's a lot of governance proposals which are now being worked upon in order to streamline and to make that CDM process more open. In terms of higher gear changes, there's discussions coming through the future negotiations on standardizing processes much more, standardizing baselines and the way that calculations are done, which would potentially have a lot to benefit the CDM, and also new areas of scope, CCS, nuclear, and other forestry activities. Something which is also coming through in the future negotiations is the idea of not only doing crediting at a project level, so at an individual factory or an individual plant, but actually taking the whole idea of crediting up to a sector level. So you'd have a sector baseline which is defined, and then the credits would be issued on the basis of whether the sector as a whole is reducing its emissions. And there's a lot of issues which need to be worked out in this, exactly how it would work and where the interest lies for the private sector in order to get involved with that, and how certainty can be given to the private sector. So those things are still very much to be worked out. But that is very much the direction that things are going in terms of the offsetting side. And there are also ways of transforming this into a trading side as well. So possible market directions, just to summarize a bit here, it does, what we have at the government level with assigned amount trading would continue if Kyoto Protocol is to continue into a second period. So that's the big question. Will there be a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol, or will it be alternatively integrated into some bigger framework which would be covering both the targets of developed countries and also the actions which are put forward by developing countries? So there's big questions there as to legal form, and they will have an impact on how the market would function. What we could expect to see a continuation of is the entity trading, company trading continuing on the similar ways that we have now. It's driven by domestic legislation rather than international agreements. And this would be decentralized, but the idea would be to try and link them up. And that's really a question of how willing the governments are to compromise their systems in order to see them linking and transferring units from one jurisdiction to another. This would be all complementing, we think, CDM, and so there is discussion about how CDM would stop, but I think it's more an issue of whether it would be simply left as it is or whether it would be tried to target it across to countries which are not so suitable for the crediting, sector crediting approaches. Right. One last slide on markets and aviation, and this is really just questions more than anything else. I think what we've been hearing here, and it's certainly true, there are very significant long-term abatement opportunities for aviation. And we've been hearing about them on the technology side, on the operations side, on the alternative fuel side. The key question is, it appears to be, and to what extent will these actually come out and bear fruit? And there are abatement opportunities all over, and I think there are various ways in order to really drive those out. One of the ways could be to be focusing on market mechanisms for aviation. There are, of course, other ways to do it, but I think it's an important area where one can actually see markets as a form of the collaboration and not necessarily an alternative to the collaboration. One of the benefits that markets do have, in particular trading approaches and offset approaches, is to level the playing field. It would mean that all players within the market are operating on the same terms, they have the same incentives, and there's a sense there that one could know that all the competitors are actually doing their share as well as doing it for themselves. And lastly, a point about targets, and this is really a lesson that's come in from the international side. Targets really do embody what the political decisions are. So they make the policy, the political decision, quantitative, sets a firm direction for where countries go. I think that's all fairly straightforward. One of the lessons that we've learnt from the international side is that it's very important as well to think not only about what the target is, but to think how it's distributed. And that really is a key step which needs to be taken beyond the point of actually formulating the target, so that everyone who's involved in making the reductions is clear about the fact that other people who also have a role to play are doing their share as well. So that is another big discussion to be had as we go forward in the aviation side. But, thanks.